person, ulul amr, those people who have authority and a divine proof. Who is that person? According to the Shia, these verses refer to the 12 Imams after the Holy Prophet. For other Islamic denominations, at least they need to find the answer to this very important question.
And many say that they should be infallibles.
Exactly. That's also one of the
main and interesting points that the Sunni scholars refer to.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to the second category of the verses, and those verses are the ones which refer to the fact that this is one of the divine promises that finally the righteous people will have the power on the earth and they will defeat the supporters of Batil or the falsehood. There are a couple of verses in this regard, and the question is that what time these verses are referring to? It has not happened yet in the history of humankind to have a time in which the truth is somehow prevailing in the whole world.
All right.
This has not happened yet. Chapter Anbiya, verse 105, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَقَدْ كَتَبْنَا فِي الزَّبُورِ مِنْ بَعْدِ الذِّكْرِ. Certainly we wrote in the Psalms, that is the book of Dawood alayhi salam, after the dhikr, which may refer to Torah, according to some scholars, أَنَّ الْأَرْضَ يَرِثُهَا عِبَادِيَ الصَّالِحُونَ. Indeed, my righteous servants shall inherit the earth. According to this verse, it is a divine promise that one day the whole earth will belong to عِبَادِيَ الصَّالِحُونَ, the righteous servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Again, we need to refer to the narrations. So, for example, in Tafsir al-Ibn Ibrahim al-Qumi, we read, this verse is referring to the time of Imam Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. Tafsir al-Qumi, volume 1, page 14. In another part of his book, he says, أَنَّ الْأَرْضَ يَرِثُهَا عِبَادِيَ الصَّالِحُونَ قَالَ الْقَائِمُ وَأَصْحَابُهُ. عِبَادِيَ الصَّالِحُونَ, my righteous servants, refers to Imam Mahdi and his companions. What about Sunni scholars? Interestingly, we have the famous Hanafi scholar Al-Qunduzi Al-Hanafi in his Yanabiyu Al-Mawadda, volume 3, page 243. After quoting this verse, he says, "Humul Qa'im wa ashabu." This verse is referring to the Qa'im and his companions. The second verse is chapter Qasas, verse 5. In this verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَنُرِيدُ أَن نَمُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعَفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنَجْعَلَهُمْ أَئِمَّةً وَنَجْعَلَهُمُ الْوَارِثِينَ. We will to show favor to those who were weak or abased in the land, and to make them the imams, the leaders, and to make them the heirs. Again, according to this verse, there are some people who are mustadaf, who are weak. I mean, they do not have power. But the divine promise is that they will be made the imams and the heirs who will defeat the falsehood and the supporters of the falsehood. Again, Qunduzi al-Hanafi, after quoting this verse, he says, أَشَارَ إِلَىٰ أَصْحَابِ الْمَهْدِ رَضِيَ اللَّهُ عَنْهُمْ. This is referring to the companions of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So who are these weak people? These are the companions of Imam Mahdi. First of all, they are weak, and after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they will be, as the verse put it, نَجَعَلَهُمْ أَئِمَّةً, they will be leading and the leaders of the people, and they will be warithin, the heirs.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
And Sheikh As-Saduq quotes Imam Hadi alayhi salam as saying, this verse is referring to us, or it was revealed about us. Now, according to Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, the Holy Prophet had a look on Imam Hadi alayhi salam and his two sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and then cried and told them that you are mustad'af after my demise, you are weak. Mufaddal ibn Umar, the companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, asked the Imam that, what do you mean and what did the Holy Prophet mean by saying that you are mustad'af after me? Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said that the Holy Prophet meant that you are the Imams after me, because Nuridu annamun ala alladhina istud'afu is referring to us, the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, and according to this verse, the mustad'af people will be the leaders and the Imams. Now, we have a very significant concept in this verse, and that is referring to alladhina istud'afu fil ard. The translation of Brother Qara'i is like who were abased in the land.
Brother Qara'i is one of the translators of Holy Quran in English. This the word mustazaf here in the narration does not exactly mean weak, you mean to say?
Yeah, those people who are not in power because of the fact that the like oppressive people, they have usurped the power from them. It doesn't mean that in and of itself, they are weak. No, we are talking about the people who do not have the power.
Inshallah, in next session as well, we'll ask you if there are any more verses. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The U.S. government has extended the federal student loan payment pause for a sixth time. 46 million Americans are still in debt over their student loans. Now, progressive politicians warn inaction on student loans could hurt Democrats in the next midterm elections. Opposers of loan debt cancellation believe that these cancellations will only increase the current alarming inflation rate. Now, this is the second consecutive year that the federal budget deficit will exceed 10% of the GDP. A non-unified Democratic Party and opposition of Republicans over debt forgiveness has left the U.S. student loan debt crisis in limbo.
Never-ending student debts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in today's episode, we'll discuss the student loan debt crisis. Will recent pause in payments bring much-needed relief to millions of borrowers? With university tuitions ever so high, will there ever be a solution to student loans? And has the government fulfilled its campaign pledge to solve this pressing crisis? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our show, Scott Hutchins, speaker at Picture of the Homeless, and Jameson Brewer, professor of social foundations of education out of the University of North Georgia. Stay with us.
Student loans have been in place in the United States for hundreds of years, However, the first federal student loan was provided in 1958 under the National Defense Education Act.
In the 1980s, the government drastically cut federal subsidized higher education funding, and as a result, university tuition skyrocketed. Then came widely available federal loans in the 1990s, which were not subsidized. So what are some of the problems with student loans today?
Well, most people can't afford to go to college without student loans unless they get some kind of scholarship, and most people don't get scholarships. And since most good jobs require you to have a college degree, whether you actually need one is another story, but since most of them require you to have a college degree, that's what they're asking for. So people need to go to college and get these degrees. And then they come out and they can't necessarily find jobs with these degrees because the market is oversaturated. So there are too many people trying to get this small number of jobs that require degrees. And then they're stuck with these loans that are often at very high percentage rates, often like 9% or so. And people try to defer them, and they can only defer them so long. Then you get like income-based repayment plans. Of course, if your income is nothing, you don't pay anything. But people are in this situation where they have this massive amount of debt. They have a promise where that if they went to college, they'd be able to get a good job. And that promise hasn't been realized. A lot of people with college degrees have good jobs, but quite a few don't.
Now, over the past decade, student loan debt in America has more than doubled from $750 billion to $1.75 trillion. Now, this amount is almost half a trillion dollars more than total auto loan debt in the country. The Biden administration is under enormous pressure to reduce this burden of debt. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Elizabeth Warren are demanding the government cancel over $50,000 per borrower. So why have the debts increased so much over the past decades?
Student loans became important, particularly post the Reagan administration in the 1980s. Prior to that time, and here in the United States, state universities were heavily subsidized by state legislatures and state budgets. Following the 1980s, we in the United States had a reimagining of what higher ed would look like, specifically no longer conceiving of it as a public good or a common good, but thinking about it in terms as an individualistic commodity. Because of that, states have dramatically cut back their subsidies for higher education institutions in the United States, and as a result of that, those costs have been shifted to students. Because those costs have been shifted to students, and over the past couple of decades, the costs have increased over time, students have been forced to turn to student loans to pick up the difference. And so we've seen a shifting of state funding of education here in the United States towards individual funding. And again, because most students cannot afford out of pocket to pay for tuition and fees, they have to resort to student loans.
Some Democrats fear that if the Democrat government does not take a decision on canceling these debts, they would suffer in the upcoming midterm elections. According to a recent poll by the Student Borrower Protection Center and Data for Progress, nearly 66% of likely voters support the forgiveness of student debt. The poll also found that more than 70% of Latino and Black voters also support this initiative. So why did Biden make a campaign promise over student loans?
A lot of it is just bloat, because the money really isn't going to the professors. The professors' salaries have basically gone up with inflation. A lot of it is just they just expand all these administrative positions. A lot of it's redundant. A lot of it's administrators giving jobs to friends and friends' kids, and that increases bloat. Some of it's used for capital improvements. A lot of colleges do a lot of building that they don't necessarily need to do, just to try to make themselves look better. And so a lot of the money goes to those places, but the place that it doesn't go to is hiring more professors, giving the professors better wages.
Since Biden took office, the U.S. Department of Education has canceled around $2 billion in student loans for more than 100,000 borrowers who have filed application alleging fraud and deception against their school. This is while in the Trump administration, tens of thousands of similar requests were rejected by then Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. Now, there is a proposal that in schools that are proven to be problematic, entire groups of student loans should be canceled. So why are university tuition fees so high?
Institutions, especially these, as we have shifted to thinking about higher education as an individualistic commodity, universities have operated along a marketplace theory. That is that if they have the better and the nicest recreation centers or dormitories, they can attract students for their business, for their money. And so there's some increased cost there. Certainly there have been some administrative bloat over the past couple of years, and I think that the combination of all of these things, and again with the reduction of state subsidies, we've seen an increased cost over the last 30 years.
Opposers of loan debt cancellations believe that the payment pause that's been underway now for more than 2 years primarily benefits the wealthy and those with higher incomes. Students who enrolled in expensive private schools or went to graduate school are the ones who have the most debt. Now, these same students are the ones who are probably wealthier and earn more income. So is canceling debt now fair to those who have paid their loans off over the years?
The ones who've paid it, it's difficult to say that they're suffering more than those who haven't paid it, because if they've paid it, that means they could pay it. A lot of people who have not paid it have not been able to pay it. So it's giving them relief, but it doesn't hurt the people who had their student loan debts and who paid off their student loan debts on their own. It's basically just a resentment issue. Was like, well, I paid off my student debts, why didn't these other people? It's like, because you got a good job and the other people didn't. So I don't really think there's a very good argument against forgiving these student loans, because the people who paid them off are the ones who could.
Community college attendees normally have less than $10,000 in debt, while graduates from private universities that go to law schools or earn their MBA, for instance, might earn six figures and have probably accumulated more than $150,000 in debt. These wealthy graduates have enough salary to pay back their loans, but now they have not been paying for 2 years and might have their loans totally forgiven. Is it correct to invest so much in higher education and not more in other areas like housing?
Yeah, certainly an individual buying a house benefits the local economy. I think that it's clear that an education and what we invest into an education tends to provide better and broader impacts and a return on investment, to use the language of a business. So investments in education, again, not only impact and benefit the individual, but they benefit the communities that they live in, the states that they live in, and the nation as a whole. And so if we have the question of, you know, do we fund education or do we fund housing? I mean, for me, you know, I would like to have a conversation about how do we do both. But I do think that there tends to be a larger return on investment when we make those into education.
The other matter to take into account is that the poorest people in the U.S. probably have no student debt at all, since they have not gone to college. According to the Pew Charitable Trusts, only 15% of U.S. adults have student debts. Although young adults with a degree have more debt, with a bachelor's degree they earn 80% more than their peers in the same age group who have only earned a high school diploma. Why not pay off mortgages of low-income individuals instead of canceling student debt?
I think that's a good idea. I don't think it needs to be an either-or issue. I think there is a bit of an aspect of how much society pushed us to go to college, and that is a major factor in it, is basically because we were given all these promises that didn't work out. But I'm definitely in favor of people having their mortgages forgiven, especially if it's on their own home. If they're a landlord, I'm not so keen on that. But if they're just trying to survive, I would agree with forgiving that as well.
Now, there are reports that a program which was developed to aid low-income borrowers and eventually offer debt cancellation was not functioning the way it was intended to. More than 9 million borrowers have enrolled in the Income-Driven Repayment Plan, the IDR, which are developed for low-income people that can only make modest monthly payments. The NPR revealed that these plans have been badly mismanaged by loan servicers and the Department of Education. So has Biden fulfilled his campaign pledge on student loans.
I mean, I can certainly appreciate that disposition. I think that, you know, we also see this when it comes to K-12 funding. You know, there will be individuals in the community who will not have children, who attend public schools just because they don't have children, or perhaps their children are grown and have moved out, who will say it's unfair for them to continue to pay local taxes to support the local schools. But of course, the problem is that even without children or children who moved on, those individuals still benefit from a community and society that makes sure that the youngest of us have an education. The same thing for college. I mean, I can appreciate that somebody who spent the latter two decades paying off their student loans might feel left out. And I think that from a policy standpoint, there can be many ways in which some of the fees that have been paid or the interest that has been paid by those individuals over the last few decades can be reversed. They can be given tax credits. I'm not an economist, but certainly it doesn't have to be black and white that if you've already paid them off, you get nothing if we move forward with loan forgiveness. But the same thing is true across other policy areas. Myself, my children are a little bit older now, and we don't use pre-K anymore. But there are conversations about making universal pre-K free and affordable to everybody. That wasn't necessarily available to us, but I'm okay with us not having gotten it as long as people in the future and families in the future can get it.
Borrowers are supposed to see their loans canceled after 20 to 25 years, but new documents show that in 2021, while there were 4.4 million people who had been repaying their debts for at least 20 years, only 32 had their loan canceled under the IDR plans. Now, some senators are calling for an investigation into these mismanagements at the U.S. Department of Education. Has the government been successful in canceling loans and giving relief during the pandemic?
It hasn't at all. I mean, Jen Psaki basically said, it's not going to happen. You're going to have to start paying again during the pandemic. It's really, there hasn't been any change. I think it was just a campaign promise to try to get the youth vote. And I think he succeeded in getting the youth vote, but he has not fulfilled the campaign promise in any way whatsoever. He had that little bit of a freeze for the pandemic, but then it was just announced that you're going to have to start paying again. The pandemic's not even over.
What is interesting is that despite opposition claims that the forgiveness of loans benefits the wealthy, a new Grinnell College National poll shows that only 12% of those making $25,000 a year or under oppose forgiving the loan, while 44% of those who make over $100,000 a year are against cancellation of debts. And those with high school diplomas support forgiving loans just as much as those with the higher education. Now, wouldn't canceling the debts cause inflation?
I'm not particularly clear on any connections with canceling student loans and Obamacare or access to health care. Certainly, because the United States does not have single-payer health care, individuals have to pay for that. If individuals are not having to spend money on paying for their student loans, that would certainly free up money for them to help afford their own personal medical insurance programs. But in terms of inflation, Something like 65% of the current outstanding student loan debt is simply interest, is projected interest on what student borrowers owe the federal government. So that's not necessarily money that they would have to print, so to speak, to cover if they forgive it. That's just simply money that the federal government would not collect, right? And so the entire $1.7 trillion of outstanding debt, if it were to be forgiven, more than half of it is just simple interest, right? It's not the actual principal. So would it contribute to inflation? I think that that's possible, but I also think given the context of the pandemic that we've been in for the last 2 years, since COVID began, the federal government has suspended the requirement to pay student loans. Me, as an example, I have student loans, and over the last 2 years, rather than paying towards those loans, I've used that money to spur the local economy, buying supplies to build onto my house and all those other things. So I really think that some of the impacts of inflation that would follow from forgiving student loans has already been priced in to the economy, because that extra money that student borrowers would then have in their pockets per month rather than paying, they've already had that for the last 2 years. So in terms of would it exacerbate inflation worse, I'm not quite certain on that.
With high inflation and the increase of living costs, millions of people owing student loans are still stressed and worried of what is to come. Millions of Americans are in debt their entire lifetime, and now that there has been a two-year pause for student debt, experts are worried that borrowers have been spending their monthly installments on other costs of living and will not really be able to pick up where they left off once payment pause is over. Now it's time we check in with Abbas Motarim to see what he has for us this week.
Student loans, they are designed to keep corporations in control and to maintain this capitalist society. In this episode of Power to the People, we're going to take a look at the student loan debt crisis, and we'll look at why it's used to maintain capitalist control over our daily lives. Student loan debt, it has millions of Americans trapped in a cycle of perpetual debt. Currently, student loan debt is estimated to be nearly $1.75 trillion. And it's spread out amongst 46 million borrowers, and this is a huge number that only continues to rise. But it wasn't always this way. Shoot, if you go ask your parents, they're gonna tell you how college was cheap, cheaper back in their day. And they's not wrong, as one of the main people responsible for student loan debt is none other than Ronald Reagan. Even while he's in his grave, his policies, his economic policies, are still terrorizing people. In 1981, the Reagan administration, alongside Republicans and conservative Democrats, they passed a combination of tax and budget cuts that significantly cut student financial aid as well as Pell Grants. And thus, federal loans, they were only made available to a small amount of the population. This was part of the conservative ideology that there should be no handouts, and this whole welfare queen idea that people should pick themselves up from their bootstraps and go get a job and work to go to college. And one of the reasons financial aid and Pell Grants were cut was also to deter black people from going to school. In the civil rights era, black students, they were beginning to get better access to education. And with that access, many black students, they were beginning to organize against white supremacist capitalism. Many of the radical movements of the 60s and the 70s, they started off on college campuses. And the biggest militant movement to be born out of the student movement was the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party, they had its roots on Merritt College campus in Oakland, California. The campus was so black and so militant, the Wall Street Journal, they called it a campus where black power won. J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director of the FBI, he declared an all-out war on the Black Panther Party and deemed them to be the biggest threat to national security. The government did anything and everything to destroy the party. At the height of the Black Panther Party's organizing, Ronald Reagan, who was the governor of California, and he worked actively, actively to stop the Panthers. So it's to no surprise that he would attack the school system in order to stop revolutionary organizing that was going on campus. And with a significant cutting of financial aid from the government, college, in many ways how it always was now exclusively in many ways for those with wealth. And because, let's be real, those with wealth, they ain't trying to change society, they want to keep it how it is. And for those who can't afford college, they now got to take out loans in order to access, to gain access to education. And this makes a huge barrier for education. And now black people are more likely to have to take out a loan to go to college and borrow more than the average college student. And white students, they are more likely to graduate with a rate of 250% more compared to black people. And this is all because of the financial challenges of the student loan crisis. The American government puts those who can't afford college in massive amounts of debt. And in many ways, this is entrapment. Rather than people now, you know, being able to actually chase their dream job or dream career, they often have to compromise because of the debt that is looming over their head. People then, in some ways, can become slaves to capitalism rather than pursuing what they really want out of this life. It must be understood that education is truly a human right. But instead, the U.S. government, they spend billions of dollars on wars. And when it comes to education, they would rather its own people spend the rest of their life in debt. This parasitic system of capitalism would rather make these corporate banks trillions than actually serving its own people. But this is exactly what capitalism is. It is inhumane, it is anti-human, and all it cares about is profit. And the only people it cares about is the people who is profiting, which is the ruling class. This is power to the people.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
We are seeing injuries we didn't see before. Pelvic fractures, spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, and a lot of open fractures when the bone comes through the skin, said a San Diego doctor. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Absolutely Tragic, Doctors Tie Trump's 30-foot border wall to surge in injuries and deaths. Here's the story. Doctors in Southern California are connecting former President Donald Trump's efforts to build a U.S.-Mexico border wall that can't be climbed with soaring rates of serious injuries and death among migrants. Seven physicians at the University of California, San Diego, detailed new statistics and their observations about local trauma cases in a research letter published recently in the journal JAMA Surgery. Under Trump, a 30-foot wall was installed across more than 400 miles, often replacing shorter barriers. The doctors focused on admissions to their trauma center after the new wall went up in California's Imperial and San Diego counties. Before the higher barrier was built, there were 67 fall admissions from the border wall compared with 375 during and after the period. The letter states, explaining that this increase of more than five times is still significant when doctors factor in average apprehensions by U.S. immigration officials. After the wall was raised, there was also a jump in depth from 0 to 16. Once you go over 20 feet and up to 30 feet, the chance of severe injury and death are higher. Dr. Jay Dossett, chief of the trauma division at UC San Diego Health, told the Washington Post, adding, "We are seeing injuries we didn't see before, pelvic fractures, spinal cord injuries, brain fractures, and a lot of open fractures when the bone comes through the skin." As the newspaper reported, at Scripps Mercy Hospital, the other major trauma center for the San Diego area, border wall fall victims accounted for 16% of the 230 patients treated last month, a higher share than gunshot and stabbing cases, according to Vishal Bansal, the director of trauma. Bansal said in an interview, "I've never seen anything like this. This is crazy." His trauma ward treated 139 border wall patients injured by falls last year, up from 41 in 2020. Hector Almeida, a 33-year-old dentist from Cuba, who was sent to UC San Diego Health after fracturing his left leg, told the Post that, "I never expected we would have to climb the wall." According to the paper, smugglers let his group to the wall with a ladder and told them to climb up and slide down the other side, said Almeida, who said he saw one woman fall and break both legs, and an older man with a severe head injury. The San Diego Union-Tribune shared what happened to a Mexican family trying to flee drug cartel violence after they were turned away by U.S. officials under the Title 42 policy while seeking asylum at the San Diego port of entry. On a foggy night in mid-March, several family members from the Mexican state of Michoacán followed the smugglers' instructions to climb the first of the two border barriers to reach U.S. soil near San Diego. One of the women felt her grip slipping on the first fence from the moisture in the air as she struggled over. When she approached the second wall looming 30 feet above her, she realized it would be impossible for her to get over safely. As she panicked, the smugglers told her to wait to the side for Border Patrol to get her so that other migrants could cross. It was only after she reached the Border Patrol station that she learned that her 14-year-old daughter, whom the smugglers sent with an earlier group, had fallen from the 30-foot wall. The woman said, "It was the worst night of my life." The woman, whose daughter remains mostly bedridden after spending a week in the hospital with a fractured skull, neck and back, added, "We had come to save our lives, not to risk them in such an awful way." Along with the human impact, the rise in falls has taken a financial toll. The letter notes that the increased hospital cost of the surge in admissions exceeded $13 million in 2021 dollars. The surge also coincided with the COVID-19 pandemic, which has strained the U.S. healthcare system, the paper points out, adding, "The care of these injured immigrants is not only a humanitarian problem, but also a public health crisis that further worsened trauma center bed capacity, staff shortages, and professionals' moral injury. Most of these patients had significant brain and facial injuries or complex fractures of the extremities or spine, with many requiring intensive care and staged operative reconstructions. Lack of health insurance made most patients ineligible for rehabilitation facilities or post-discharge physical therapy, further lengthening prolonged hospital stays." The letter says that the Title 42 policy, enabling U.S. officials to swiftly expel many migrants like the family from Mekonnen, may have increased the numbers and desperation of persons crossing the border away from ports of entry and increased the number of falls. The Title 42 policy was implemented under Trump and continued under Biden, who plans to end it next month, though some lawmakers are pushing to extend it with a bill that critics say ignores individuals and families in desperate need of safety and their right to seek protection from persecution.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, you are welcome to Like Muhammad with me, Javed Akbari. In this episode, we are going to study and to shed some light, in fact, on the Prophet's seerah and on the Prophet's normative conduct after Hijrah, after the Prophet's migration from Mecca to Medina. A study of the prophetic normative conduct in dealing with the polytheists and disbelievers is necessary from two perspectives. One, a study of the targets and objectives of the Prophet's wars, and a study of the Prophet's dealings with the hypocrites. Now, there are some conflicting reports, and these reports are found in some sources. The Orientalists have also played a very destructive role in highlighting and also claiming, making some claims about the Prophet's wars against the infidels, against the, you know, kuffar of Mecca and the kuffar of Quraysh. Of course, to a large extent, they have exaggerated when it comes to the Prophet's conduct or the conduct of his commanders and companions towards the infidels. A historical review of the Prophet's battles demonstrates that he never actually permitted the Muslims to go to war without the polytheists cowardly initiating it. You know, it was first the polytheists who either breached or violated the contracts, the agreements reached between the prophet and his companions on the one side and the polytheists on the other side. So they were the ones who actually broke and who violated, who infringed upon those agreements. And when the polytheists of Mecca, for example, confiscated the property belonging to Muslims, the Prophet ordered the caravan of Abu Sufyan to be seized. And this is true with the Prophet of Islam. It was then and there that upon encountering the Meccan army, he issued the command for jihad to confront their advance.
My heart is so full of longing. I wish to be close to my beloved. I dream to walk in the streets of Medina and to quench the thirst of my spirit by visiting you, O Muhammad.
The Prophet had fought many battles with the polytheists, and of course he did not wage a war initially. He did not fight them unless they attacked them. So the Prophet acted in self-defense rather than launching an offensive on the enemies. The example of the Battle of Uhud, it is an example it was that we can give. It was the polytheists who had initiated the battle to make amends for their losses, to retaliate for the losses they suffered in the Battle of Badr. In the battles against the Jews of Medina, their treachery and broken pledges were the principal causes that led the Prophet to issue the command for jihad, to ask his companions to go to war against those treacherous and those violators or those pagans who launched an offensive against the Prophet and against the Muslims. The conquest of Mecca, which occurred, of course, in the last year of the Prophet's life, started only after the polytheists broke the terms of the agreement of Hudaybiyah. And of course, you can read about Hudaybiyah, about the Battle of Uhud, about the Battle of Badr in more detail in the books written by prominent Shia scholars. There are important books written and translated into English, and you brothers and sisters can read those books to enrich your knowledge, to improve your knowledge about the Islamic history, about what happened in the early period of Islam. Now, after establishing an Islamic government in Medina, of course, the Prophet never took the initiative to kill the polytheists there. On the contrary, his interaction with them was one of love and affection. It was one of mercy and compassion. He never ever acted in the same way as the polytheists did. When the Prophet was alone, when the number of his friends were few and far between, the Prophet never retaliated. During the Battle of Uhud, when the enemies had broken his teeth and bruised his blessed face, his holy face, his companions asked him to curse the polytheists. His companions were very angry. They wanted him to curse the polytheists so that God might send down his punishments on those polytheists. But instead of that, the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, responded, "I wasn't raised to be a curser. I was raised to be a caller, a mercy, rahmah. O Allah, guide my people, for certainly they are ignorant." So ignorance is the main cause of the atrocities, the fighting, the bloodshed that occurred on the part of the polytheists in the early period of Islam.
هجرا جئت بعد العسر يسرا ربنا أعلاك قدرا يا إمام الأنبياء يا حبيبي يا محمد يا نبي السلام عليك يا رسول سلام عليك يا حبيب سلام عليك صلوات الله عليك.
The Prophet of Islam threw the drops of blood trickling down his face into the air. And of course, not a single drop fell back to the earth, according to some reports. Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam says, by Allah, had even a drop fallen down on the earth, the punishment would certainly have descended. And this is what we said in one of the previous episodes. So the same Imam alayhi salatu wasalam narrates, the Prophet never attacked the enemy by night. It is evident that a reformer who is anxious to guide the people of the whole world must observe patience, fortitude, and forbearance in the face of inconveniences, intimidations, dastardly attacks, and corporal and mental blows, so that by and by he should be able to overcome difficulties. And this is what the Prophet actually did. When the Prophet entered Mecca with a large number of soldiers, Sa'd ibn Ubadah, the standard bearer, was crying out, today is the day of war, today is the day of revenge. Today your dear ones will be imprisoned. And this is a very famous motto, Al-Yawm Yawm Al-Malhama, Al-Yawm Tastahillu Al-Hurma. Today is the day of revenge, and today all the inviolable will be violable. All the prohibited things will become halal. When the news reached the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, he instructed Imam Ali, والسلام, his son-in-law, to take the standard from Sa'd and call out a message of love and friendship. Ali والسلام, did so, and he called out, today is the day of forgiveness. Al-Yawm Yawm Al-Marhama. This is the report. فقال النبي صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم لأمير المؤمنين عليه الصلاة والسلام أدرك يا علي سعدا وخذ الراية منه وكن أنت الذي تدخل بها. Okay, you have to take the standard and you should be the one who will command the army and will enter the city of Mecca. So, brothers and sisters, the story of the conquest of Mecca is long. Of course, if you are interested in learning more, you will have to study the books authored by the religious authorities. There are some important books written in this regard. You will have to and you need to read those books. Those books can enrich your knowledge, can help you improve your awareness and insight about the history of Islam. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum. ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafiullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, the friend. Ya Rasulullah, Rasulullah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.